Hey, Scotch and Reason listeners. Today we have something a little bit different for you. If Scotch and Reason was a punk band, this would be the EDM remix of that song you like. There's no group of people sitting around a bar, and there's no scotch this time, unfortunately. It's just me interviewing Stephen Costello in my photography studio. It's a straight-up, stripped-down question and answer. Who is Stephen Costello, and how dare he interrupt the steady flow of whiskey and banter? Well, when you get a man with a comprehensive and intimate 28-year knowledge of the Korean Peninsula agree to sit down with you for a talk, you take what you can get. And if you steady nerd on foreign affairs like I do and just want to chill out on the entire North Korea thing, Stephen is definitely your person. We'll join the interview just as Stephen is explaining just who he is and what he's been up to all these years. Enjoy.
Thank you, Stephen. I really appreciate you being here for us, kind of helping our Scotch and Reason listeners understand a little bit more about the North Korea situation. It's obviously a present situation, ever-changing, it seems. And since the introduction of North Korea's nuclear capabilities, it seems more urgent than ever. Now, before we get into that, I do want to understand a little bit about how you got here, what you've done, and particularly your work on Northeast Asia and North Korea.
It's terrific to be invited on your show, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
This is very timely as well, with the Olympics going on in South Korea. I've been a rather rare South Korea expert for about 28 years. I first got started as a political advisor to the South Korean Democrats way back in 1990. At that time, they were preparing to contest the presidential election of 1992. So I met Kim Dae-jung and a lot of the members of the party. And in those years, they were just trying to modernize the party. And so part of our duty was to give them tips on how modern parties in the U.S. manage the message, so on and so forth, how they package things, how they speak to people, so on and so forth. So that was my beginning.
Okay. So then, you mentioned, if I may, South Korean Democrats.
Yes.
So let's play a little game here. What are the prevailing parties in South Korea? Are they the same as when you started? How do they contrast with our parties and our party systems?
It's actually quite similar to our party systems in the sense that there are two main parties, conservatives and Democrats, and they have broken up and formed different ones. But there have been basically two big groups. And of course, the important thing about my involvement in all this and the important thing about that year of 1990 is that the Democrats had never been in power in South Korea, I mean, ever. So they were coming off the Korean War in 50-53, and they had never had a Democrat. It had been a rather authoritarian regime. So my whole involvement in this from the beginning was a democratization issue. These Democrats were committed parliamentarians. They had a party in the parliament, and they were contesting things within the laws and within the parliament, even though it was a very tilted playing field and it wasn't really fair. So the whole effort of the South Korean Democrats to finally win an election and to have power was the big thing. So it was democracy. And although they lost that election in 1992, a non-military guy did win, Kim Yong-sam. So that was progress. And 5 years later, in the next presidential election, Kim Dae-jung won. I mean, against all the odds, on his fourth try.
And that was because of you, of course.
Right? It was all my doing. No. But it was an awful lot of, I was just keeping my eyes open and my mouth shut a lot of this time and helping out. And it was an incredible education for me, both about what goes on in South Korea, its democratization movement, but also, of course, about the Americans who were involved in all this and about American policy. So I got a very good grounding, between 90 and, say, 97 when Kim Dae-jung was elected president.
I guess it stands to reason you've spent a fair amount of time in South Korea. When was the last time you were there?
I was there about four weeks ago for 10 days. So I got a really good fill-up on all their preparations for the coming Olympics. At that time, we were only, a month or so after Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, had said, actually, maybe I will come to the Olympics.
Right.
So this opened all kinds of possibilities. This South Korean government wants to try some North-South rapprochement, and so they're working on it. They invited the North Koreans to come down. You may appreciate, the day that I arrived in Seoul was the 21st of January, and the first North Korean, she was a singer and a very senior North Korean person, both in the hierarchy and as a singer. She was arriving to check out the venues. And every screen in the town was glued to her every move. It was like Michael Jackson and the Pope combined. It was an amazing coverage, but it gives you a sense of just how kind of momentous they feel.
She must have been quite the exotic figure.
She's an exotic figure. She's gorgeous, and she had this big fur collar. And she wouldn't say much. She would just smile and visit all the venues. And, you know, the South Koreans are, oh, my God, you know, they're like the North Koreans in a sense. And with the division, particularly the last 10 years, as policy's been frozen, they've had their own kind of narrow news about North Korea. You know, are they crazy? Are they all starving? You know, blah, blah, blah. And to have this person who's kind of, you know, well done, obviously on top of her game, was a real big revelation to a lot of people.
You mentioned something about the South Koreans and how they view the North Koreans. And we obviously have our own optics. We have our own lens through which we get to view North Korea based on U.S. media, international media. How does that contrast? Does it contrast with what the South Koreans know about their, you know, next door neighbor?
It contrasts only a bit. You know, we know less than the South Koreans know. We often forget that the South Koreans, particularly the professional South Koreans, government people, intelligence people, they've been living right next door to these folks since they were born. So it's likely that they know them a little better than we do. The other thing is that, paradoxically, with our open society, we don't get a lot of news about North Korea inside what goes on. This is largely a consequence of the fact that we sort of froze our relationships. Back in about 2001, we stopped active diplomacy with them. So that, you know, our knowledge of North Korea is not very good.
Was the freezing of diplomatic relations, was that a consequence of the George Bush doctrine of sort of the axis of evil, where we said Iran, Iraq, and North Korea were this triumvirate of evil? Is that when it happened?
That's when it happened. And you know, the axis of evil is a good reminder, but of course that was very much the result of what they were doing, not the cause of it. I mean, they came in. It's good to remember that all throughout the 90s, when the Clinton administration was sewing together this outreach and diplomacy with North and South Korea and kind of working together, and they achieved some agreements by the end of the 90s, all during that period, Republicans in the U.S. Congress were screaming, don't do this, don't shake their hands, you know, they're going to get us, let's just crush them, blah, blah, blah. That's kind of the mindset that came into power in the White House in 2001. So despite whatever gains there had been from these agreements, the people who came in were kind of dead set against those agreements from day one.
So what do you think the source of that outcry was from the Republican Party? Why were they so dead set against what the Clinton administration was doing? Did they have insight that the Clinton administration wasn't looking at, or was it just an ideological difference?
It was largely an ideological difference, but it too is part of a whole. I mean, it really is a 30-year, 40-year political process that we've gone through. I have never viewed this, although I worked with Democrats in South Korea, as that much of a left-right issue. It never really has been. It's really been much more of a kind of strategic understanding issue versus a kind of shallow political, you know, use this as a football issue. And one way to view that, the way Republicans, and not only Republicans, but many people thought about that back then, you know, don't shake their hand, they're evil, is to look at today. I mean, that same group is now trying to destroy the agreement with Iran, which caps their nuclear program. They don't have any nuclear weapons right now, but it's capped on an agreement we made with the Europeans and Russians and everybody. We've capped it, and we're working it, and they're living up to their part of the bargain. Well, these Republicans want to destroy that. They're doing everything they can to take it apart. It's an ongoing issue every day in Washington. Same with the Cuba rapprochement. There's been some rapprochement with Cuba. So this is, you know, if you look at Cuba, Iran, and what we did in North Korea under these folks, you can see that they have a real issue with just talking to bad guys. They don't like it. It doesn't work for them. Unfortunately, that's kind of the level we're at.
So I'm going to go back sort of the average citizen. And this would be on both the U.S. side and on the North Korean side. So what do you believe? I know there's scant, if any, news or information about what the average North Korean citizen knows other than defectors. And I believe there is actually some controversy over defectors and what they say and what they're paid to say. But leaving that aside, what do you believe the average North Korean citizen knows about its relation with the world?
You know, North Korea is one of the most isolated places on Earth. And that is a consequence of their history primarily. But in these last couple of decades, they have continued to be isolated because whatever, you know, budding interaction there was with South Korea and the U.S. didn't get off the ground too much. So North Koreans are fed a pretty steady diet of what the outside world is like. And, you know, predictably, that's directed to make them toughen up and be ready for anything. It's also true that they have a very real history in the 50s of being carpet bombed by the U.S. and having a very bad history with the Americans. So it's not hard for them to extrapolate, well, if these Americans are threatening us, we better be tough. The average North Korean probably feels very much under the gun and under threat from the Americans.
Now let's go to the next level of North Koreans, not to rank them as humans, but just on the basis of information. Now you have the actual administration of North Korea. You have the government, the military, which I think would be the ruling class of North Korea. Now, obviously, the Korean War and the devastation of that Korean Peninsula during that time, that would have affected how North Koreans, older specifically, view the U.S. and the Western powers. So let's say that the up-and-coming, the new regime, Kim Jong-un represented a youth movement in North Korea. How do they view the West, and is it informed by more than just the Korean War?
Well, that's an excellent point in a way, because Kim Jong-un is in his early 30s, and many of the senior people in the military side, and even I think on the political side, are rather old. So during his time, which might be 20 years or 30 years or so, there's no doubt, as you say, that there will be a new generation in North Korea coming up. It is possible for us outsiders to influence how they see the rest of the world, but in order to influence them, we'd have to have more interaction. As it stands today, to answer your question, they're rather sophisticated in the sense that their top diplomats and their top people read papers all the time. They read Korean newspapers, which are in Korean, all the time, and they have access. There are translators. So in a very odd situation, particularly lately, you have both Americans and even some South Korean government people who are dealing with these things who, you know, this might not have been their job 5 or 10 years ago. So these are rather new people. If you look at our president, our ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, these are all people very new at their jobs. I mean, they might have been good at something, but to do what they're doing now, this is brand new for them. In North Korea, it's very different. They've been doing this for decades. They know the history. So in the weirdest sense, the most isolated country has, in some places, a very experienced diplomatic corps. Of course, what they're after is, you know, survival and getting out of this mess and deterrence and all these other things. So our interests and our aims may be different. But you're talking about worldviews, and among the elites, you know, they go to China, they travel a bit. So the North Korean elites are not totally out of it. They read the papers. The other thing I'd throw in here is that there's always the other dimension to the average North Korea, which is that they're humans. I remember 20 years ago talking to a senior reporter who was talking to Kim Dae-jung in Washington at the time. And this person was saying that when they walked around North Korea with their minders back in the mid or early 90s, when there was a quiet time, their minder would say, "How can I get my son a computer? Can you help me with that?" So, you know, you have this very human thing that's always there. And North Koreans are, in that sense, not much different. They're isolated, but they're not dumb and they're not crazy.
No. And I think that's played out over the years every time we've had an enemy and we demonize the populace, because it's important to do that when you're pushing an agenda. But in the end, it was the old, I can't remember the name of the Sting song, but it was the, "I hope the Russians love their children too." This is during the Cold War.
Sure.
And the humanizing aspect of, you know, maybe we're not going to destroy each other in a flurry of nuclear explosions, because in the end, we all have the same interest. We all want to raise our children and be fruitful and be successful and be safe.
Well, that has a direct relevance to a lot of the way we talk about these issues today, and even the way the American public hears things, because one of the efforts on the part of the leaders in the White House right now and in the Congress is to paint Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, as out of control, irrational. We have to stop him. He's about to bomb us. But of course, if you have spent any time looking at this, if you listen to what the intelligence people say, or journalists who've been over there or others, the opposite is really true, in the sense that Kim is, as you say, quite rational. I mean, he's got a dictatorship, and it's a family dictatorship. It's a rule by one person, one family, but they have their interests, and their interests would not be served by attacking anybody. So just about everything they do is defensive. That might not sit very well with the kind of messages that our leaders in the U.S. want to give us right now, but it's probably true.
So when we do hear concerns from, let's say, not South Korea, because we hear a lot about that. They share the border. There's a long history, tense history. Somebody like Japan, Philippines, Taiwan, places like this, even Soviet Union, going back to my Cold War days, to Russia and to China, you know, their views seem to align with ours, that they're concerned about the rationality of Kim Jong-un and his regime. They're closer to it. They're obviously more within range of anything that Kim Jong-un and the military could do. So do they have a different view of this than the U.S. does? Are they lining up with us per treaty and by alliance, sending out the same message? Or are we just not hearing it correctly?
I think it's hard to hear it correctly, because most of them have an interest in lowering the temperature, obviously, for all these reasons. They also do have, and they share, an interest in denuclearization, in getting those nuclear weapons under control, first of all in North Korea, and then eliminate them. North Korea should not have become a nuclear power. They should not have been able to build nuclear weapons. That was a diplomatic and political mistake. But it has happened. And Russia and China, for instance, because they're bordering North Korea and because their economics are somewhat linked, you know, to this region continuing to thrive, they would very much like it if we got control of this nuclear program of North Korea's. They don't believe, and never have believed, that that could be done by pressuring them, sanctioning or pressuring them. They've known all along, they know the North Koreans, and of course they wouldn't give in. They're not going to surrender, not going to happen. Therefore, they have always, from the beginning, supported a diplomatic solution, a negotiated solution. South Korea is very much the same way. Because of South Korea's unique history with its northern neighbor, they have additional fears because they can imagine that the North still wants to reunify the peninsula under the North, you know, blah, blah, blah. That has not been practical for probably 20 years, and it's never going to happen. And the North Korean leaders very likely know that. Most people who've spoken to them have made it clear to them. So the idea that they dream of a united Korean peninsula under their leadership is pretty much bogus. So yes, everybody has concerns. And you talk about Japan and the Philippines, you know, their real, if you take a step back, their biggest concern today may be that the Americans will spark some kind of war or some kind of military confrontation with the North. They are probably less concerned that the North will lash out unprovoked at somebody, because that doesn't make any sense.
Right. So it's not a rational thing, given their position.
No.
Yeah. So, and I agree with that, even though I'm not an expert, but in my very amateur opinion, I agree. So in talking about Russia and China, if you grew up during the Cold War, you got the sense that you were supposed to, it was your patriotic duty to lump every communist into the same pot. Russia is not a communist country anymore, although there are a fair amount of elements still in place that were under that regime. Putin was raised, you know, in that regime and was high up in that regime. China is still a communist country, even though they have democratic reforms and economics specifically. But they differ quite a bit from North Korea. So can you explain the differences there? And should we think of them as puppets for the Russians and the Chinese?
Yeah, that's a great question, and particularly for Americans who have lived through this whole Cold War era and know the danger from communism itself. Probably part of the answer is that communism as we knew it back then no longer exists. You know, you could make a case that the Chinese don't really believe in communism. They're for making money and markets and so on and so forth. As you said, you can make that case for the Russians as well. What's interesting, you know, Kim Dae-jung, the former South Korean president, he used to say that it was the Vietnamese we should look at as a model somewhat for the North Koreans, because they've been able to keep a communist government. They have one today. But they also have a private sector and private property and you know, commerce and interactions with the Americans. So they're trying to, you know, walk that line. It's not easy, it's not pretty, but they do it every day. So it's appropriate to see these really all as a bunch of disparate peoples. The real way to link the way they think about North Korea in their neighborhood is it's really linking through historical experience. You know, they know what happened in the past. They know the wars. They know that going back in the last few centuries, China and Japan invaded the Korean Peninsula 100 times or more. Therefore, the Korean Peninsula as a place is not a source of invading anybody. They've only been a source of instability because the Korean War is not over. You know, they haven't figured it out.
Technically speaking, we're still at war, right?
Yep. And remarkably, part of the reason of that is the democratization, the slow democratization of South Korea. Again, I'm going to refer to my old friend, the former President Kim Dae-jung, who during his whole, you know, democratization career in South Korea, he was saying, you're never going to have a rapprochement with North Korea and make the peninsula whole again until South Korea is fully democratic. One of the reasons for that is that conservatives and sort of old-line forces in South Korea will always use this division to try to retain power. And of course, he's right. It's right up to the last president. And so the issue of democratization for, you know, think of it, South Korea and Japan are our strong democracy. They're like us that way. That's a big deal. And yet, in terms of economics and interests, there's quite a lot of overlap. That's one reason why we have become close to China over the decades. It's one reason why we still deal with Russia, as much of a pain in the neck as that might be. You know, economics trumps everything. And if you can put your diplomats to work, they will solve it. It's one thing to remember that diplomats know what's possible, and they're really good at their job. The real challenge is to unchain them and let them do their thing, because again and again, it has often been political leadership, either whether it's in South Korea or Japan or the U.S. or somewhere, who have upended or made it more difficult to reach those agreements that would bring us forward.
So you talk about South Korea and becoming fully democratic and evening out the influence of the hardline old regimes of South Korea. Do you see then, if there's a chance for a normalized relationship with North Korea, not just with the U.S., but with the world, is South Korea the key?
I think it is. And I think it, in some ways, always has been. For any student or anybody who really is interested in this stuff, the period of the 1990s is absolutely fascinating because leaders in North Korea and South Korea and the U.S. had been trying, they'd been picking at this problem over the years. They all knew the Korean War wasn't over. It was dangerous. It was not good. The North Korean people were suffering, obviously. So they tried and tried. And the prospect that there could be some rapprochement or some deals is tantalizing for a whole number of reasons. I have been particularly focused on the kind of economic reasons, the economic logic of closer cooperation. But you will find that in the 90s, the South Koreans and the North Koreans began to talk. And very quickly, they began to agree on the most basic cross-border economic things. That's why you have the Kaesong Industrial Complex just over the border in the north. That's why you had a Mount Kumgang tourist operation, tours to a mountain in North Korea. And as soon as that began to happen, Japan and China and Russia all started to say, well, I guess we see which way this is going, and embraced it. They weren't pushing back. Let's remember, too, as a little sidelight, that the Americans were always happy to stay, you know, where they were in South Korea. There was no appetite here for going up to the Chinese border. So the downside from the Chinese view of its security and so on was minimal. The real gold mine here, the gold bucket at the end of the rainbow here, is increasing economic cooperation north and south, which spreads to eastern China and Russia, which are undeveloped, and which would eventually link to Japan, which is the biggest economy, you know, after China. It's more modern. So there is a kind of economic renaissance that everyone's been kind of waiting for, planning for. People have plans on the books, on the shelves, and they're waiting for the politicians and the leaders to kind of get out of the way and allow this to move forward.
Fascinating. Really is. So as part of the name for the podcast of Scotch and Reason, I want to introduce a little bit of reason, and I'm hoping you can provide it. For the average American citizen who's listening and reading and watching the various sabers being rattled by the Trump administration and the Jong-un, or is it more appropriate to say, I'll just say Kim Jong-un administration regime, what are the things that we should know? What should we know? What should put us at ease about this situation?
I'd say two main things. One, on the risks of conflict or war or even nuclear war. There have been a lot of reasons to be worried as heck for the last several months because of all the rhetoric. I would say out there that that's not really necessary. It is very highly unlikely we're going to get into any military exchanges. There are a bunch of reasons for that, but briefly, it's not in anyone's interest to do it. The Americans couldn't do it in any kind of a quiet way and keep it limited. That's not possible. So it's such a risk that nobody would take that. As a small side detail, it would be illegal and unjustified in any military strategic way, but that does not seem to be the top concern of a lot of people talking. So people should not be too worried about that. That's not really it. Second thing I would say is, you know, the budding diplomacy between the Koreas that surrounds the Olympics is very important and very interesting. One of the things to note about that is it's not new. This was all done at the end of the 1990s. That was only 20 years ago. So this is not some new thing that they're talking. This is basically picking up where they left off 20 years ago. I wouldn't say for certain they're going to do this. I hope they do, but once again, it's politicians and entrenched interests and all the things that one could go into that could stand in the way. In a larger strategic sense, in economics, as I've been talking about, there's every reason to keep going with this slow rapprochement, capture their nuclear system, make a trade for letting them off some sanctions and do what diplomats do. You know, from my experience watching this up close for 28 years, I would say that's doable. Whether the people currently in power can do it, I'm not sure. But I'm just cautiously optimistic. You know, if you're interested in these issues, follow the news. Be careful who you listen to. And remember that the rationale for military action and all those things is not very strong. There are much better rationales for the other.
Stephen, I want to thank you for coming on, providing your wisdom to us, and I hope that we can get you back on at some point in the future.
It's been terrific to be here. Great questions, and thanks a lot.
And that is what it's like to talk to someone who knows what they're talking about. And I agree with them. Yeah, there's a potential for bad things to happen, just like there has been for the past 60 years. But we're looking fine for now. Ignore the tweets. Have a cocktail. Okay, those are my words, not his, but you get the point. Stephen was just as disappointed as I was that we didn't have time for a drink, but he has promised to be back with us as soon as he's able. And that's it for this special edition of Scotch and Reason. Please don't forget to tell your friends to subscribe, download, and listen. We can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. And let us know what you think, what you drink, and what you'd like to hear about. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Oh, and if you'd like to know the taping schedule so you can have a drink with us while we tape, email us at scotchandreason@gmail.com. We'd love to have you. Until next time, I'm your host, Don Mears. Cheers.